This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, the Senate approved the Unborn Victims of Violence Act and sent it to President Bush, who's expected to sign it soon. The measure says that if you attack a pregnant woman, you can be charged with the crime against the fetus as well as the woman. Because this would be a federal law, it affects a small number of cases. Many states already have laws to protect the fetus. We'll take a look at how these state laws compare to the federal measure and about the argument of its opponents who say that it threatens a woman's right to choose abortion. We'll also bring you up to date on court challenges to the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, which President Bush signed last fall. So where are fetal violence laws? How are they used? And how do they change the debate over abortion? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And NPR's health policy correspondent Julie Rovner joins us now from the Capitol. And good to have you on the program, as always.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Briefly, what's the outline of the act that was passed last week by Congress?
Well, it's a fairly simple law. It's actually only a couple of pages. It makes it a separate federal crime to injure or kill what is called a child in utero during commission of a federal violent crime. And a child in utero is defined as a member of the species Homo sapiens at any stage of development who's carried in the womb. So that basically goes back to whenever you think life begins, at the very moment of conception.
Now, how many, again, this is a federal law, how many cases would this actually affect over the course of a year?
Well, it has to be, and this is according to the sponsors, it must be one of 68 separately enumerated federal crimes of violence in the U.S. Code. Now, those are mostly crimes that take place on federal property, on a military base in a national park, or crimes against federal workers. But it also covers things like drug-related shootings or attacking a witness in a federal trial. The last numbers that I saw were from 2001. There were several hundred federal violent crimes. It's not clear how many of those were against pregnant women, but one would assume that it would be a small subset of that. So we're not talking about a large number of crimes.
Now, there are two very high-profile cases involving this set of issues at the moment. One is the Lacey Peterson murder. The other is a woman in Utah who refused a cesarean section while delivering and had twins, and one of the twins died. Would this law, just as an example, have had any effect on either of those cases?
No, actually, it wouldn't have, and for two different reasons. The Lacey Peterson murder, there's a California law that does apply. That was not a federal crime. Assuming that the accused estranged husband is or isn't guilty, regardless of whether he is charged, and that it did not take place on federal property, it didn't have anything really to do. There's nothing about that crime, if that is indeed what happened, that would make it a federal crime. In the Utah case, there's an actual explicit exemption in the federal law for you cannot prosecute a pregnant woman for conduct that she takes that results in the death of the fetus. That is explicitly excluded, as is abortion, although this does come into play in the abortion debate.
Mm-hmm. And again, in the federal law, is there obviously, if violence against the fetus, certainly abortion could be considered that by some people. Does this law cover that?
It doesn't, and that's why the people who are backing it say that this is not an abortion-related argument, although there are others who do say it's abortion-related, because they say the intent of the law to create separate personhood for the fetus, separate from the mother, could be used later to undercut a right to abortion. So that's how it enters the abortion debate, although, in fact, abortion is not covered. You cannot prosecute using this law for activities related to an abortion.
The other thing that some opponents of this law talk about is its definition of life as beginning at the moment of conception. Now, that could also be used in this debate.
That is exactly the concern of many of the people who oppose the law. There are these 29 states that have their own laws, and they don't all go back that far. Some of them do, but many of them only apply to fetuses after viability.
Now, how many states have laws that protect the fetus in this kind of way?
At the moment, there seem to be 29 states. It's confusing. There's a few states that have some conflicting laws, but basically we have 29 states that we can sort of look at that have some laws on this subject.
And those laws, they take effect at different times of the fetus's life, from some at conception, some at quickening, some at third trimester?
Right. Well, some of them actually say a viable fetus, and that would be fairly late in pregnancy after, again, these are sort of moving targets, but generally after 23, 24, 25, 26 weeks. Some of them actually talk about injuring or killing a quickened child, and that quickening is something that happens after the first trimester, but before viability, usually somewhere between 13 and 20 weeks. Some of them, actually about more than a dozen of them, are like this law that's about to become a federal law, do start at any stage of development. Some of them use the word conception. Some of them use the word fertilization. Some of them just say any stage of development. So there are different language that's being used in these.
To be approved, especially in the United States Senate, this had to have been accepted by any number of senators who would have opposed a law that directly threatened a woman's right to choose abortion. What did they say in explanation as to why they think this was not about abortion?
Well, basically what happened was there was a key vote in the middle of this debate on an amendment offered by Senator Feinstein, Democrat of California, that would have enhanced penalties for a federal violent crime against a pregnant woman, but would not have created a second victim. That has been offered in the House. The House has actually passed this bill, I think, four times now. That was offered in the House and defeated in the House several times. In the Senate, it lost by a single vote. That was considered the pivotal vote where abortion rights supporters could say, look, we agree that there should be more penalties when someone injures or kills a fetus, when someone attacks a pregnant woman and there's injury or death to the fetus, but we don't think we want to create a second victim and then get into this whole issue of are you establishing federal personhood. Once that went down, there were a lot of even members who support abortion rights and who don't like it, who nonetheless sort of felt compelled to vote for it because it looks bad to vote against something that says we don't think you should punish people who injure or kill fetuses while they're attacking a pregnant woman. Mm-hmm. So it passed by, the bill passed by more votes than that amendment fell by.
Okay. Now, last fall, the Republicans passed the Partial Birth Abortion Act, and President Bush signed it. What did that cover? And as soon as it was passed, of course, there were challenges expected in court, and they arrived yesterday.
Yes, they did. The trials began yesterday. Three simultaneous trials, one in New York, one in Lincoln, Nebraska, one in San Francisco, all by different sort of abortion rights groups who are challenging the law. They are basically saying that it suffers from the same flaws that got a Nebraska law struck down 4 years ago by the Supreme Court, that it is, that the definition of this procedure is so vague that it could cover not just this particular procedure that sponsors say they want to ban, but could cover other procedures that are much more common. They also say that its lack of a health exception, allowing this procedure to be used to protect the health of the pregnant woman, makes it unconstitutional on its face. That was basically what the Supreme Court said 4 years ago. The key difference here is that in the bill that became law were congressional findings that said that this particular procedure is never necessary to protect the health of the woman. Basically, what's on trial are the validity of those findings. They are trying whether or not Congress was correct in saying that there's never a medical necessity for this procedure, and thus they don't need a health exception.
And does that mean that while these cases are being heard, that the law is on hold, or what?
Well, the law is mostly on hold. It's confusing because there were three separate injunctions, and the injunctions could be lifted now that the injunctions basically went through when the trials were to begin. So the injunctions could be lifted at any point, and so we could end up with a situation where the law could be enforced against some people but not against others, depending on which of these groups they fall in, whether they're covered by these various injunctions. That we're not there yet, but that could happen.
Okay. Thanks for the update.
Sure.
Julie Rovner is NPR's health policy correspondent. She joined us from the Capitol. And we're going to get back now to the fetal homicide laws. Joining us from his office in Garrison, New York, is Daniel Callahan, co-founder of the Hastings Center, which is a think tank on bioethics. Currently, he's director of their international program. It's good to speak with you.
Hello.
How do these laws on fetal violence affect the ethics of the abortion debate?
Well, that remains to be seen. The interesting thing, I've been following this debate literally for 40 years now, since the mid-60s. I don't think the essential ethical issues have changed a great deal over the years. That is to say, people still argue about when life begins, who do we want to call a person, and the rights of the mother. And interestingly, public opinion surveys have not changed greatly over the years. Roughly 20% of people very strongly pro-life, 20% pro-choice, and the rest people and somewhere in between. But there have been a number of other developments which I think have subtly shifted at least the political and perhaps the medical context. First of all, we have in recent years developed all sorts of sophisticated technologies to scan and look at the fetus. Women regularly have sonograms made these days, so they get to see the fetus. And I think the very fact of visualizing something which had basically been hidden before has made some psychological difference with many women, at any rate.
I read a story just the other day that there was one of these sonogram machines. They're going to put it in a mall, so you can go get a picture of your baby at the mall.
Yes, well, I think there'll probably be a lot of takers for that.
Yeah.
Another thing that's important is that there is a great deal. There's been a great deal of interest in recent years in better health behavior on the part of pregnant women, since we know that smoking, drinking, use of other drugs and the like can do harm to the fetus. And that has really called attention to the fact that this fetus, if it's a wanted child, will have its life impaired, perhaps in a very drastic way, if the mother really engages in unhealthy behavior. I think a third change has been there's probably just a more widespread and effective use of contraception, too. And I believe that's made a subtle difference, at least that more women are able to protect themselves from getting pregnant in the first place. And I suspect, finally, the whole conservative movement is a much stronger movement than it was at one time. The conservative movement was a much more minor thing at the time of Roe v. Wade, but by not just in the realm of sexuality and other things, but it's become much more powerful. So you have a lot of things. I would lay the emphasis heavily on the technological and medical. The question always has been, I suppose, from a philosophical point of view, what's the difference between an unwanted and a wanted fetus, or an unwanted and a wanted child? And, of course, the answer, Freud's choice answer, is always, well, the mother wants it. But then the question is, but it's the same fetus, and of course, when you begin scanning and looking at fetuses, you recognize that they have a certain potential. So, too, if the mother engages in unhealthy behavior, that's going to make a great difference. So, one way or the other, the fetus has kind of emerged from the shadows in a funny way, a biological shadow, and that people didn't know much about it, but also it's become a more prominent part of the debate itself, I think.
Let's get some listeners on the line. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us, TOTN@npr.org. Roberta joins us on the line from Williamsburg, Virginia.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a couple of questions. What if the fetus, if there's a crime committed and the fetus dies but the mother survives, and the other, could the mother be charged if she commits manslaughter, say, and the fetus dies?
If she commits manslaughter against her own fetus, are you talking about?
Or, say, for instance, if she's in a hit-and-run accident or something like that.
A vehicular homicide against somebody else.
Yeah, and she survives.
But has a miscarriage, yes. All right. Daniel Callahan?
I'm not a legal expert on that sort of issue. It seems to me there's a really classic case of how people would read the law. And I think in the latter case of the mother actually doing the harm herself, well, some states have tried, not very successfully, to punish women who, again, by, say, taking drugs and the like, have harmed their fetuses, but those efforts have not gotten very far. My guess in both cases is that they probably would not charge the mother, but a lot depends on what a prosecutor decides to do and how a prosecutor reads the law and whether he's zealous enough to push something like that.
But would, in the first case, would the person who tried to kill the mother but only killed the child, would they be prosecuted?
Well, it sounds like technically, at least as I understand the law, that is certainly a theoretical possibility.
And even whether or not they knew that the woman was pregnant.
Yeah.
So that's another possibility. Roberta, thanks very much for the question.
Mm-hmm.
We're speaking with bioethicist Daniel Callahan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email question we got from Keith in Silver Spring, Maryland. Where does the evidence of intent come into this? And that's exactly what we were talking about before.
I suspect it'd be very, very difficult to prove intent. I mean, it's very difficult in the law to prove intent. We know that somebody has done something, but trying to read their minds to figure out what they had in mind, that's always, of course, been the difference between murder and manslaughter. Manslaughter is when you might accidentally kill somebody. You may have intended to, and you've made it look like an accident. And then the question is, did you really want to? And which would be murder? And it's a difficult question in law. And I think in cases of this sort, it would be very difficult indeed. And I suppose the fetus could be killed maybe more by a kind of negligence on the part of the mother, and then where the intent was not to kill the fetus, but the mother simply didn't take proper precautions to keep it alive.
And that would not be part of the federal law, but it would be applicable in some of these state laws.
Some of the states, as I understand it.
Yes, I understand it as well. Let me ask you, as you look at this debate, talk about both sides, if you would. What ethical questions should both sides be pushing themselves on?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've always felt that each of these sides should be arguing with themselves a little bit more, not just the other side. I guess I would say for the pro-choice side, they, I felt over the years, have not really paid sufficient attention to the status of the fetus, because basically it's an issue which tends to challenge their very, very position, that it should be simply a matter of choice on the part of the mother. So I would hope that the pro-choice side would take more seriously all of the developments in our new knowledge of the fetus and perhaps be a little more sensitive to say at least as yes, legally the mother should continue to have the choice, but we would hope that we would get mothers very sensitive to the status of the fetus and that it would be a serious moral dilemma for them. From the pro-life side, I think they have unfortunately both sides, it seems to me, have been utterly dogmatic and intransigent. I think from the pro-choice side, they simply have to continue recognizing that, look, this is something that very fundamentally affects the fate and welfare and future of a woman. We are divided as a society on this. Illegal abortion, which probably would happen if it's not legal, is a very bad outcome also, and themselves to be much more sensitive to the context of the lives of women who have children that they had not planned on and cannot deal with.
We just have a few seconds left, but I did want to ask you about the discrepancy in all of these different laws about a vital issue, and that's when life begins. And it's another issue, of course, medical technology has been very active on.
Well, that has been the issue from the very start, and that issue has been around for a long time. I myself have never felt we really can solve that question by looking at the biology alone. There are all sorts of different stages in the development of human life. I think most these days, one difference is almost everyone agree that human life begins at conception, but the philosophical question is more turned on at what point do we want to say that this begins to become a person and therefore is subject to the protection of law. And that's a more subtle question, which I don't think can be answered with biological evidence. It's really to be a fundamental question of how we want to think about preserving and protecting human life and what kinds of dangers there are in deciding that some forms of human life, for instance, do not deserve equal protection. So you get this problem. But then you get a similar problem these days at the end of life with, say, people who are in an irreversible coma.
Another show, though, Daniel Callahan.
All right.
Daniel Callahan is a bioethicist at Hastings Center, which he co-founded, currently directs their international program. Advocates from both sides when we come back from a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're discussing the landscape of fetal rights issues. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. In a few minutes, we'll hear from the National Right to Life Committee, but joining us now is Kate Michaelman. She's the president of NARAL Pro-Choice America and joins us on the phone from North Carolina. Good of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Briefly, can you describe for us NARAL's disagreements with the Victims' Rights Act or the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act?
Well, I would start with saying there's absolutely no disagreement on the horrific nature of violent crimes against a pregnant woman that results in harm to her pregnancy or indeed ends her pregnancy and robs that woman of a hope for future child. These are horrific acts and they're terrible ones. And we at NARAL Pro-Choice America, and indeed the pro-choice movement, is committed to the fundamental right of every woman to act on her choice to have a child and to bring new life into this world when she chooses to. And we oppose any attempt to deny them, women, of that right, whether it be by anti-choice judges or violent criminals. So just to be clear about that, the reason that we oppose this bill is that, and the reason that we're concerned about the bill and supported the Senator Feinstein's alternative to the bill, which was the Motherhood Protection Act, mm-hmm. Was simple, that her bill was a bill that created a federal crime that gave harsher penalties to the criminal or the person who conducted the violence against the woman that harmed her fetus or her pregnancy. But it did so without embroiling the debate or the issue in the issue of protecting pregnant women against harm, violence, in the abortion debate. The only difference between the bill, the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, and the Feinstein alternative is quite simple. The bill passed gives separate legal status to an embryo or a fetus. The reason it's there, the reason that it does so, was explained by an anti-choice leader in his own words. He said, as in many areas as we can, we want to put on the books that the embryo is a person, and that sets the stage for a judge to acknowledge that human beings at any stage of development deserve protection, even protection that would trump a woman's interest in terminating her pregnancy. So I think that's what the Unborn Victims of Violence Act's intent is. While we would like to have seen a bill passed that would not create a tension between a woman's and her right to reproductive freedom and choice and her right to bear a child and to punish those who do anything to interrupt her right to do so healthily.
Let's get a caller involved in the conversation. And Cliff joins us now on the line from St. Augustine, Florida.
Hey, and thank you for your time. And Kate, pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
May I ask you something?
Yes.
Do you not feel like you're opening the slippery slope argument when you simply say that a law passed to end violence, you know, crime, criminal violence, it could also be used to end legal, what you would consider a legal procedure? I mean, there's nothing in this law that's designed inherently to prevent abortion. This law.
Indeed, the law specifically excludes abortion.
Exactly. So
well, it excludes legal abortion.
Yes.
The phrase.
Well, it ought to exclude illegal abortion if it is illegal, indeed. But
it's not, Cliff,
right now,
but go ahead.
Right now, abortion being legal, it is excluded. And if it ever becomes illegal, it would be excluded. My thing is, don't you feel like you're opening a slippery slope to say, well, this could apply to this, or this could apply to that, or this could open it? And you hear a lot of people arguing against the slippery slope in other cases right now.
Right. I mean, it's a good point and an interesting one. Our goal was to focus the law on the crime against the woman. The pregnancy is part of the woman, and the violence done to her that results in harm to her pregnancy should be addressed as additional added harm, additional harm, robbing her of a right to bear a child safely. And that is what the bill should have addressed and that's what the Motherhood Protection Act did. And again, this bill simply sets the stage to create a legal rationale for overturning Roe versus Wade, and clearly with potential Supreme Court vacancies looming, opponents of abortion are doing everything possible to create the conditions in which a court that's had its numbers bolstered, anti-choice numbers bolstered, could achieve the goal of reversing Roe versus Wade. And this bill, the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, could be, and I think will be, if the court goes in that direction, part and parcel of that overarching campaign.
Now, the president is expected to sign it into law. At that point, would you expect court challenges to ensue?
You know, I don't know, Neil. I don't know that there will be court challenges. I do think it's a significant development that will, for the first time in federal law, recognize an embryo as a separate, distinct person under the law. And you mentioned, well, the law exempts legal abortion. The goal of this law is to create the legal underpinnings, the legal rationale for overturning Roe by recognizing the embryo as something, as an entity, a legal entity, distinct and separate from the woman. It really, as I said, creates a conflict between a woman and her pregnancy, unnecessarily so. I think this wasn't necessary. And at the same time, I also want to, I was listening to your interview with Dan Callahan.
And if you could keep it quick, because
we're... Sure. I think, you know, we recognize and appreciate, and I, as a woman who had three children, do appreciate that pregnancy represents the potential for human life. And the longer a pregnancy goes, the more complex the issues become, and we recognize that. Indeed, Roe versus Wade recognized that, and in the late stage of pregnancy, states are able to prohibit abortion under Roe versus Wade as long as they make an exception to protect a woman's life as if it is at risk by the pregnancy or her health if it's at risk. And so I think the law Roe versus Wade currently recognizes that, the value of potential life, and pays attention to it in the law.
Kate Michaelman, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Kate Michaelman, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, joined us on the phone from North Carolina. With us now is Douglas Johnson, legislative director of the National Right to Life Committee. He's at his office in Maryland, and good of you to be with us today.
Good to be with you.
As you heard Kate Michaelman say, she thinks this law was not really about protection of the fetus. This is a law designed to undermine support for abortion or lay the legal groundwork for a movement to undermine Roe versus Wade.
Well, you know, the listeners heard Daniel Callahan say that he thinks just about everybody recognizes that human life does begin at conception, and then it's a question of what protection or what status to afford after that point. And we are the people who believe that members of the human family, human species, have an intrinsic right to life, and we think that should be recognized in different areas of the law. And that's why we're against abortion. But, you know, abortion is a very important pro-life issue. It's not the only right-to-life issue. The criminals who are attacking pregnant women, injuring or killing them and their unborn children, are not performing abortions. Their actions are not shielded by Roe versus Wade. As was mentioned by Julie Rovner, 29 states already allow homicide charges to be filed on behalf of an unborn child. Some of these have been on the law, on the books for decades, like the California law. They have not impacted on abortion. We think that this is worth doing in its own right, because, regrettably, there are a lot of these types of crimes. It's an error what was stated earlier that there are only hundreds a year. There are thousands a year that are covered by violent crimes that are prosecuted in the federal system. It's certainly true that we need state laws as well, and we have worked for those.
Well, the majority, excuse me, we're speaking with Douglas Johnson, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And the question I wanted to ask there is, in the states, do you know how many, and state laws are very different, and there are at least 29 of them, but do you know how many times these laws are applied against perpetrators of violence against women and fetuses, and how many times there are charges brought against the woman under these laws for neglect, as we saw in Utah?
Well, of these 29 fetal homicide laws, like the federal bill that just passed, they virtually all have exclusions, not only for abortion, but for anything that the woman does herself. Now, there have been some confused reports out of Utah about the case that was mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, the sources are in so much conflict on that, I can't figure out what is going on there. If that is an example, it would be an extremely unusual circumstance, and that would not be permitted under most laws. I don't want to comment on the case because I just don't have the facts. There have been such contradictory information in the media. But most of these fetal homicide laws, virtually all of them, explicitly exclude abortion, and not just legal abortion, by the way, in the federal bill, but any abortion to which the woman consents, and also anything that the woman does to herself. What these bills deal with, it all boils down to one thing. And during the Senate floor debate, on the floor of the Senate, there were photographs shown of these crimes, what we call two-victim crimes. Anybody who wants to see some of these photographs can go to our website at nrlc.org. NRLC for National Right to Life Committee.org. And you'll see, for example, on the front page there, a photo of a young woman named Tracy Marciniak holding her son. It takes you a moment to realize that he's not sleeping. He's deceased. It was taken at his funeral. He was killed in her womb in the ninth month, and then she was told, she survived. She was told by prosecutors they could only charge that man for aggravated assault because that state did not have a fetal homicide law. That's the law today as we speak in federal jurisdictions. That's what the prosecutors have to tell women who are in that situation. And that's what they would have had to tell them still if the amendment that Kate Michelman supported, the Feinstein substitute, had been adopted, because that would have written it into the federal code that these crimes have only one victim. There is a consensus on this, but it's not the consensus that Kate Michelman was talking about. There have been a number of public opinion polls done on this issue in the last year that have asked questions that got right to the heart of the matter. In these types of crimes, like the Lacey Connor Peterson crime, should there be one homicide charge or two? And these polls have consistently found from 79% to 84% of the people say that should be two homicide charges. 69% of the people who call themselves pro-choice agreed with that in one of these polls last year. So I'd call that pretty close to a consensus. And in view of that consensus, actually, it's remarkable that the Senate split almost down the middle on the question as they chose between the one victim and the two victim.
Structures. Let's get a listener involved in the conversation. This is Bill, who's on the line with us from Carrboro, North Carolina.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
One thing that's gotten little coverage is the Senate defeated an amendment to the bill called the Paul and Sheila Wellstone Amendment, which would have protected victims of domestic violence by giving them the ability to take unpaid leave and some other benefits. I think it's very indicative of the real issue behind this bill, is the fact that the Senate, as they voted, and proponents of the bill only care about women who are killed or seriously injured. You know, they don't care about preventing domestic violence, and they showed that by defeating that amendment. So I could talk more about it, but I know you're running out of time.
Well, also, but did you have a question about this bill in particular?
Yeah, well, my comment about the bill is that the proponents of it don't really care about preventing violence against women. They care about using this as an entree into the abortion issue.
The same point that Kate Michelman made earlier, Douglas Johnson.
Well, the bill explicitly exempts abortion, so that it would be a strange way to go about it, wouldn't it? We think this is worth doing in its own right. These criminals aren't doing abortions, but they are depriving these unborn children of their right to life, so it should not be a surprise to anybody why an organization called Right to Life would want to deter such crimes or see justice when they do occur. You know, the most eloquent voices for this bill were the family members of families who have lost loved ones, born and unborn, in these types of crimes. These aren't political activists. These are people who've been drawn into this by the terrible things that happened to their family, and there were quite a number of them in Washington last week to talk with senators, including Lacey Peterson's mother and stepfather, but also a number of others not so renowned in the media, with heart-rending stories, many of them told on our website at nrlc.org. And they all, regardless of their position on abortion, they all say, we lost not just a daughter, we lost a grandchild. Or the women who survived these crimes invariably say, he killed my baby. None of them have this ideological construct that their reproductive autonomy was impeded or any of that stuff. They recognize that they lost a child, and they are offended that the law doesn't recognize it. And they argued most eloquently against the Feinstein Amendment because it would have written into federal law that there is no dead baby, there's no dead baby in the picture, and that there's no dead baby in the crimes that affected their own families. And they're offended by that.
Doug Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Douglas Johnson is Legislative Director for the National Right to Life Committee and joined us from his office in Maryland. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.